Hello, and welcome to a whole new episode of Content Rookie. I'm going to make this intro really quick because there's two dogs and a baby right next to me. Today's guest is Yael, who recently published a book on the business of UX writing. So today we're going to talk about what that means, how you can get closer to business stakeholders and why you may want to do that, what the ROI of UX writing is. And we're, of course, also going to talk about her experience in the field, how she got into it, and have a little bit of a casual conversation about everything that's going on in the world. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome to Content Rookie, Yael. Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. I'm Yael Ben-David, and I'm a senior content designer here in Israel.
Cool. Yael, you originally reached out because we wanted to chat a little bit about the ROI of UX writing, but also because you wrote a great book recently, a book that in the content design field hasn't really been there yet, or there's no competition for your book, where you talk about the business of UX writing, which I think is super interesting. So I would love to just ask you to elaborate a little bit about, how did you come up with the idea? How did it happen? What was the process like? And anything else you'd want to share about that?
Sure. So something I think that's really cool that's happening in our industry now is we are moving from a generalist perspective to more of a specialist. So for a long time, nobody knew what was going on, including those of us who were practicing it day to day. We're all flying by the seat of our pants and figuring out baseline consensus around what it means to do content design and UX writing. And so we were all sort of generalists. And now I feel that we're more established. There are people deep diving into accessibility and conversation design. And so I really found this place I wanted to deep dive was the business side of it all. Mm-hmm. And before I got into tech and into UX writing and all that, I was a neurobiologist in a lab. And So data was very top of mind for me. And so I think that was sort of a natural direction for me to want to deep dive into. And I don't want to say no competition or whatever. And also I'm really happy that now these days I do see a lot more people talking about it. But a couple years ago when I first started putting together talks based on my own research and things I'd been able to try at the companies where I was working and stuff like that, I didn't see a lot of people talking about it, which meant there were a lot of opportunities for me to fill a void. And then I just, the more I thought about it and the more kind of content I collected around it and the more I had to say, there was finally enough for a book. So I love writing. So I wrote the book.
That's really cool. I mean, I also love writing. I've also been wanting to write a book that is related to my work. But every time I start, I realize, you know what? There's too many good books out there. Maybe I don't have that much to say. So kudos to you. I haven't read it yet, but it's in the mail. So I'm excited to get into it. I would love to... This is a little bit of a sideline topic, so let me know if you're comfortable talking about it. But we are going through economically a little bit more difficult times, specifically in tech right now. There's a lot of layoffs going on, specifically content design teams in a couple of places. Also, some bigger name companies have been hit quite hard. And I'm wondering what you think. Do you think this could be a little bit of a case for the business reasoning, that ROI aspect, that maybe companies still don't really see the ROI of UX writing and content design?
Absolutely. So first of all, I do feel for everyone going through what's going on right now. It is not simple, especially when you hear about people where it's not only an economic version, but also have complicated visa issues. Mm. So a lot of people are going through a lot, and we all just, I think, need to be empathetic about that. I also was at a company that laid off 40%, so that's a really big deal. Mm-hmm. I do have that, having been said, I believe that it's economically speaking a natural dip, and I don't think it's this kind of black swan event and the world is crashing down around us. I do think that we will bounce back. And it's just a matter of what we all do in the meantime. So something that's been cool for me is, so I also left my last company and will shortly be announcing where I've decided to go next. But in the process of finding that place, I had a lot of conversations about a lot of opportunities that I probably would not have considered in a different market. Mm-hmm. And I also spoke to some small startups who said that this is an amazing silver lining for them because they couldn't compete when it was market. They just don't have the funding or the perks or whatever it is to attract top talent. Yeah. And, you know, always creativity, I think, is born from adversity somewhat. And so it's kind of cool that I had the opportunity to speak to companies I might not otherwise have been in touch with. And I think some really deserving companies that in a different market might not have been able to recruit the talent they need to level up and take it to the next stage can. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it right now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I always joke, since I also talk with a lot of startups, just because I've been teaching a lot in the field and, well, people kind of know me, at least here in the European startup scene. And it's funny because I always feel like startups would actually benefit more from more senior content designers than most of the bigger name companies, just because they have teams and they have, you know, the resources to take on someone a little bit more junior or less experienced and kind of train them. They have all the documentation, all of that. While a startup, they have to build all of that from scratch. They need someone quite senior to come in and really know what they're doing. However, they can basically never afford that person.
Yeah.
Or that person would be looking for something else because, yeah, you know, there, like you said, there's also perks and job security and things like that involved, since most of us more senior folks have families and things like that. So I think it's a really good point what you're saying, and maybe we can encourage some of the folks currently looking that, you know, take that startup adventure and actually see a little bit more impact from your work, which is something maybe a lot of us or some of us feel is lacking at the bigger name companies.
Yeah, and also more autonomy when you're kind of the only practitioner, and especially when the company is small and really looking to each expert to bring expertise and respect that and are hungry for what you have to offer. It does give you a lot of room, I hope, in a healthy culture to explore new kinds of projects, to dabble in ops if you hadn't yet, to really, when you have that sort of agency and that trust of a company to all this stuff you've heard about at conferences and read about on blogs or in books, to go ahead and realize that they were looking for that sandbox to play in.
Right.
So that can be cool.
Yeah, and I think it's also a really good opportunity, or at least for me in the past, it's been also what kind of helped me niche down. Like we started this conversation with today, that you're saying people are moving a little bit away from being generalists and maybe to being a little bit more niche and specialized. And I think in order to do that, you need to have maybe done a couple of things. And that usually is a little bit easier to do in a smaller company or in a startup where, you know, it's kind of just like keep on going and run with things. And you can try out and you can see what you actually like or what you're good at or what you really want to learn more about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It gives you a chance to try a bunch of stuff and then empowers you to make the decision of where you feel like you excel, mm-hmm. as opposed to in a big company where you might be boxed in and it's not, you know, a judgment call. If that's what's right for that org, then that's cool. But, you know, for those of us who are really looking to grow in our field, it might not be the best thing for the stage where we're at. And it does, I agree with you. You started the question with tying it back to ROI. And I definitely think that this is a market where we can make the case where if we bring the business case, companies are going to be receptive to it because they're desperate for frugal ways to have a big impact on the bottom line. And a lot of times microcopy and product copy in general achieve that.
Right. So I'm curious to just kind of zoom out completely, and I would love to ask you, how would you define the ROI of UX writing? Like how, you know, did you pitch that book to your publisher and how did you kind of break it down? Yeah.
Sure. So the way that the part that the publisher really return on investment, and it was more about this perspective I'm trying to bring and trying to highlight of UX writing practitioners considering business stakeholders real partners, mm-hmm. and important collaborators. And the way I see it is that for a long time, for good reason, there's been this almost like adversarial relationship for user advocates, whether that's UX designers, researchers, writers, whatever, us UXers who are the voice of the user inside of the company, mm-hmm. are almost feel that we're head to head with business stakeholders, and that things that we want to do that require resources, it's a zero sum game, and it has to come at the expense of something that they want, and it's tug of war. And I'm kind of trying to come and say that that's actually not what's in the user. So our version to date of advocating for the user is no longer that which most best behooves the user, and that the business stakeholder and the user and us are all in the same boat, and we all sink or swim together. So I'm trying, like, the whole perspective of the book is how can we work with business stakeholders together toward that joint goal of improving a user experience, because better, happier users are better for the business bottom line. And it's all about how we're all codependent. We all need each other. The business needs users to be successful and for them to engage, and users need the business to do whatever it is they came into the product to do. So, like, without the business, there's no app to do whatever it was they wanted to do in it. So I'm trying to look holistically at this ecosystem of players and of partners. And then the next level after that is like, okay, that's a nice sort of high level perspective, but what does it actually mean? And then drilling down into the, okay, when if we want to act on and manifest that attitude, we need to treat sometimes our business stakeholders as users, in the sense that we need to use language that resonates with them. And so talking about numbers and return on investment is often a good way to do that. And then it just, like, goes from there. And then the book just sort of dives into a, you know, higher in resolution about how we do that, and, you know, a playbook for our day-to-day and things like that.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to me but maybe it is because I actually did go to business school. For me, this link has always been a very vital part of any content design or UX writing, and I always try to add that to any kind of explorations I do. You know, thoughts about engagement and thoughts about click-through rates and all those things that maybe actually are more popular in marketing and business teams than they actually are on content design teams. But I definitely have noticed over the course of my career that a lot of people come in and they're not that familiar with the business numbers and the business way of looking at things. And I definitely agree with you. I've also worked in places where it really felt like UX or like product design versus the business side, and, you know, the teams kind of look at each other in this weird way, like the business team looks at the UX team as like these creative folks that don't really care about the numbers, and then the UX team will look at the business team as these like crazy people that don't care about the users, that just want their money. So I definitely think it's a super important job that you're doing, both with your book and also by talking about this, to actually tell people, hey, you know what, like, that's not how you should look at it.
Yeah, thank you. I hope it's helpful to everyone involved on all sides. I also think that some of this is coming from UX writers, like, I don't want to say bringing it on ourselves, but like not seeing ourselves as, like, not feeling, I don't want to say like the right, but like almost that it's not our place to go out and ask for more business context. And that we have this sort of fear that we'll be rebuffed and it has nothing to do with you and you just write the words. But honestly, I have not found that in the field. I have found that the more curiosity we show, the more fruitful collaborations come for everyone. And that if you ask business stakeholders like what they care about and what they're working on, and even try to understand what they're being measured on as professionals, and speak to how you can facilitate that and support them, it really goes a long way, and they really appreciate it, and that it really, we need to not be afraid to ask for that. And if we are rebuffed, really coming from a place of ignorance, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but just honestly not understanding what our potential contribution is or what we do. And so it's on us to just, you know, very patiently and empathetically explain and educate. And I just think that kind of attitude can go a long way.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. A funny anecdote, I actually joined as a freelancer a team in a pretty big company, one of the very popular ones. And the first thing I did, I was the first UX writer on that team, is that I set up a regular check-in with their business slash marketing slash campaigning team to like make sure that, you know, tone and voice actually was at least a little bit aligned. Because there's also often this understanding that, you know, the marketing team can do whatever they want. The product team does whatever they want in terms of like copy, which I personally don't agree with. Anyhow, so I set up like a regular check-in and even facilitated some cross-functional crits. They were super, super fruitful. It was great. It did just improve the collaboration. It also really improved the product. So I highly recommend this. And the reason why I'm sharing it is that in the beginning when I set up these check-ins, people were really confused about why I was doing it. And the designers were like, we don't normally do this. And the people in the business team were like, we don't really like know what to look for, what to give feedback for. So it was also a lot of like educating each other. But I feel like it was really, really worth it. So I can definitely recommend it if you have a little bit more freedom on how you want to run your UX writing slash content design work. This is definitely something worth exploring.
Yeah, I totally agree. I had a very similar experience. I was the only UX writer in the company, and I was the only writer in the Tel Aviv office. Mm-hmm. Everyone else was in San Francisco. And so almost out of, you know, selfishness, because I was lonely, and, you know, you need someone to geek out over M-dashes with and things like that. I just didn't have anyone. So I created essentially this guild. And over time, it became, we had our own rituals and our own just all kinds of processes, and it became a really fruitful forum. And like you said, we had check-ins once a week and other ways to keep in touch async in between, make decisions about the style guide, make sure the voice was aligned across the product and the marketing comp. And it was extremely fruitful and also extremely fun. We had matching t-shirts, and I'm actually no longer working there and still in touch with some of them because it just was such a positive, like, warm personal experience. Mm-hmm. And separately from that, I had set up a process with some of the business stakeholders because we felt as writers that sometimes we were too late in access. So I just kind of said, why don't we talk with them directly and sooner? And there was no pushback to that, obviously, just nobody had said it before. Right. And if I sat around waiting for someone to offer to speak to me directly and early, it was never going to happen. So it was on me to take that initiative. And I started meeting usually twice per project, once at the very beginning to have sort of a kickoff and ask about, you know, what are the conventions in this field? You know, like, I'm a UX writer, I can write any product, it doesn't matter the vertical or the industry. So within each company, I need to go to the industry experts, and they need to shed light on their field of expertise. So they would kind of brief me and the marketing copywriter on what they felt were the most important things we should know. And then we get some feedback, tested everything we learned, and they could course correct a little bit. And then we could go write all the things with the confidence that we were getting it right. So yeah, like what you did and what I did, like, definitely agree with you and recommend it to whoever finds themselves in a position where they're able.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good example as well. And for me, it also kind of actually connects to, like, we talk so much in the field about wanting to be more inclusive and breaking down barriers. And for me, this is part of it. Like, everyone ideally should have a little bit at least of an understanding on how content design or UX writing works, because it can benefit parts outside of our team and teams that are not directly connected to design. And I've seen that happen many, many times. And again, it's usually easier to spot these changes in a smaller place like a startup, but you can also see these things really benefit work in a bigger company. So that's definitely also something worth thinking about.
Yeah, totally.
So, Yael, I'm curious, we didn't really dive into that in the beginning, but I would love to know a little bit more about your journey in the UX writing field. So you said you started out as a microbiologist. So then what happened?
Yeah, actually, I guess the beginning goes 10 years before that. I did my first degree at New York University in journalism, specifically print journalism, and really enjoyed the studies, and then worked in it a bit and decided I didn't like the industry. Like, I didn't want to work as a journalist, even though I enjoyed learning to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for something else to do. Really had no idea what direction to go in, and ended up working at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, mm-hmm. basically the biggest, best cancer center in the world, and worked with a medical oncologist who I'm still in touch with today. We had a really close relationship and started helping her. It was mostly an admin role, but because I showed interest and initiative, I was able to help her a bit with some of the research she was doing. And really was excited about medical research. So that's when I made a big shift and got into medical neurobiology. I did a master's and a PhD at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, wow. which is basically part of the hospital there, the Hadassah Hospital, mm-hmm. and hated it. So I realized I needed to not stay in neurobiology either, but because my lab focused on genetics techniques, my heritage, a genealogy company, but who also has some writer who understood genetics and could also write UX. And when they met me, they were like, okay, we'll take two out of three. We can't teach someone to write and we can't teach someone genetics, but UX will teach if you're coming in with everything else and willing to learn. Mm-hmm. So that's where I discovered UX, totally fell in love with it, and was also really happy to have found a place where I could leverage all those past experiences and not kind of throw whatever it was, 10, 15 years of education down the drain in a sense, mm-hmm. but also not do things that made me unhappy, like work as a journalist or a scientist. And then that's it. From there, like, the rest is history. I went to Funbox, and at that point, you know, it didn't matter that I shifted out of writing about genetics. Like, that was my foot in the door. But after that, like I said, what I had to offer companies was an expertise in UX writing. It didn't matter the specific industry. So I shifted into fintech because I really liked working for complex products and really focusing on what I feel is giving access to innovative tech to mass markets by right. sort of being that translator that explains how to use stuff that they otherwise would not be able to use. I'm less, it's yet just less my bailiwick, the whole writing in fun and unique voices and tones. I'm more about just translate the tech, make it usable. And so that was really awesome. And that's what I've been doing since.
Cool. Thanks so much for sharing. And you dropped a few really important wisdom bombs there. Number one being that you took initiative and you were willing to learn new things and kind of carve your path out, which I think is a really great example, and also good advice for, I know we have a lot of more junior listeners or people that are maybe thinking about getting into content design and UX writing. Some of them are always very fearful or hesitant to try it out because they worry that they don't know enough. But if you really want to learn, there's usually great opportunities to do that. And then the second thing I really want to also plus one is that you said the industry really doesn't matter that much. And I totally agree with that. I mean, as someone that was freelance for many, many years, I've worked basically, I feel like, with any industry in the world, and it has only benefited my work. And I always get a little bit sad when I have like a recruiter or someone reach out saying they are specifically looking for someone that has a bunch of industry experience, for example, in fintech, because I feel like they could probably also benefit working with someone that maybe doesn't have that industry experience yet and is coming with a totally fresh set of eyes. So yeah.
I agree with you. I think it's a big mistake because I think it shows a bit of an immature sort of misunderstanding of what it means to hire a content designer.
Yeah.
That when you're hiring a content designer or a product manager for that matter, or a front end developer, our job, our skill set is applicable to any industry. And exactly. If they don't get that, then they don't get that. And I think it's a shame, and I think that it's their loss. Similarly, I spoke to a company recently who said that they were looking for someone with a particular voice. Like, what does that even mean? If I can only write in one voice, then what, I can only work at one company my whole life? Like, clearly a UX writer worth their salt can write in any product voice. You give me the voice tone. I teach a university course, and it's one of the exercises I do with my students is now write the same message in this voice, write the same message in this voice. Now shift the tone. Now, you know, shift the voice, don't shift the tone. Shift the tone, don't shift the voice. Like, we need to be able to do that. Yeah. So, yeah, but like, it's okay. It's okay. You know, we're all learning and recruiters are learning what it means to recruit us, and that's okay. And there's always going to be growing pains, and we'll all be better off on the other side.
Yeah. No, that's a really fun example with the tone voice. Cause I've also definitely had people reach out to me saying like, hey, I really like how bald you write, and like, you know, write my personal stuff, basically like my LinkedIn posts or whatever I'm writing. And I'm always like, well, I mean, I'm glad that there's something you latched onto, but that's not really the point. The point is we need to find the voice that's right for you. And it may be similar to my personal one, but it probably isn't. And I can help you figure that out. So yeah, I think it's really good to point that out as well. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's actually something that was really fun about writing the book, was it was like the one time I got to write in my own voice. Like, yeah. This was the product here, like, is Yael. And my dad actually called it out when he got his copy and he was reading it. He said, it's like you're sitting in the room with me. My parents live in the States. So yeah, it was really sweet that he felt like I was that much closer, because reading the book, you really heard me talking. So yeah, it was like, as a US writer who's always writing in someone else's voice, that was a really fun opportunity.
That's really cute that you said that. Okay, so the one thing I really still want to ask you about as a fellow writer that actually does love writing outside of content design and UX writing, how was the process of writing the book? How did you do it? How long did it take you? What did you think was maybe much harder than you expected or easier than you expected? I'm just curious.
Sure. So I would say that, so different publishers, here's advice for people looking to write a book. And also, I want to call out something you said earlier, which was, you know, your hesitation to writing a book is like, what do I have to say? What do I have to contribute? So I totally don't agree with that. I think everyone has unique knowledge and experience and perspective to contribute. And there are a million bazillion design books, and there are not a million bazillion content design books, and everybody should write one. So there, I've said my piece. So basically, different publishers have different formats in which they expect proposals. Mm-hmm. And a book of parts is one of the kind of most demanding, but I mean that in a good way, because they really required me to think out that outline and all kinds of things, like the audience it would be for and like lots of stuff just to pitch it. So by the time that they were interested, I had so much to work with. So that made it a lot easier. And then I basically started by just filling in the outline. So I had, you know, like how we do in high school or middle school or whatever, you know, Roman numeral one and then A, B, C, like that. I just started writing under each title. And that took about 3 months. I mean, it was four, but the second to last month, my entire family got COVID one after the next. So we were all out of commission. So that month doesn't count. Yeah. So it was 3 months of actually writing. And that was really the fun part, because it just sort of, I mean, we're writers. It's like how we express our soul. And I felt like I just like, you know, downloaded my brain onto the screen, and it was fun and it was fast and it flowed. And then came all the editing. And that was not fun because the editing's where it started to feel like work. But I was very lucky to work with fantastic editors, and it was really cool. So the way a book of art does it is they put you first through like a dev edit, and then they put you through a line edit and a copy edit, and like there's all these different like levels of resolution one after the next, and each is by a different editor.
Wow.
Who brings even more niche skill set and fresh eyes each time. And so as not super fun as it was to edit, it was worth it, because at the end of each round, I was always blown away by the delta. Like, wow, how did it get that much better again? So I'm just really grateful to everyone who worked on it, and that's the process.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing. So I actually lied a little bit in the beginning. I have published a book, but it's a poetry collection. And I also had a very intense editing process. I know I'm a little bit traumatized from that. But the funny thing is since it was poetry and it's a very personal thing to put out there, and then when you have various people come in and, give you thoughts on, yeah, maybe you should change this wording or this. I mean, that was very intense for me on an emotional level. But maybe
Wow.
it was a little bit more, yeah, it was maybe easier for you to appreciate it, because I think that's something that's actually keeping me back from writing another book. I was like, wow, it feels like they're criticizing my soul. That is, if there's one specific thing or one piece of advice that you would like to share with the audience, as your kind of final words.
I would say don't let imposter syndrome control you. Don't let it prevent you from doing things. It's okay to have imposter syndrome. It's normal. I've seen research that 70% of people experience it. So it's fine. You don't have to get rid of it, but just don't let it stop you from doing things. Do things despite it. I've done a lot of things that I looked back afterwards, like a PhD in neurobiology and publishing a book, and was like, what did I just do? But I really think we can all do it. Just you're your own biggest obstacle usually. That's my advice.
Wow, and I think that is really, really great advice. Thank you so much for sharing that, and thank you so much for sharing everything you've shared today, Yael. We really, really appreciate it, and I hope your book becomes super, super popular and we all get a little bit closer to our business buddies.
Thank you for having me, and it was a really fun conversation.
All right. Thank And that was it for today's episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening week after week. And as usual, feel free to connect with Yael or me and send any questions and feedback you may have, or anything your heart desires. See you again next time. Bye bye.